Okay. For those who, I see people here who haven't said they've attended, at the end maybe you can just come up and check it off. In thinking of different types of judgment of pleasure, we are thinking of pleasure not as something that is immediate, because in rooting it through judgment, what we are getting is, I want to say, an intentional account of the meaning of pleasure. Or, to put it differently, that there are different kinds of pleasures, or different kinds of pleasures have different kinds of meanings, by the intentional route through which we come to experience them. Now, this point is, so what I'm suggesting is Kant is here saying something controversial, because you may think nothing can be more immediate than a feeling of pleasure, right? And that's the model of, you know, the tasty bit of chocolate cake, or a bit of crack.
That's great.
That's quick.
That's a structured pleasure.
Is it?
No.
You want it? No. the point here is I'm claiming that this type of pleasure is not purely causal. And we have to understand how pleasures can be both pleasures and not, as it were, directly causal or only causal. And this is particularly strenuous in this area, because the judgment of taste is equally non-conceptual and non-cognitive. It's about a relationship, again, between the harmony of the faculties. And the pleasure in the judgment is therefore both causal and intentional. The intentional moment being that we become aware of the harmony through the pleasure, and in finding ourselves in that harmony, give it an evaluative worth. Our giving it an evaluative worth comes out in our claim, X is beautiful. So what we've done is take our experience of pleasure and on the basis of that made a judgment that Kant's going to claim is objective. Right? I mean, there are people, I'm one of them, who get no pleasure from chocolate. Right? I don't understand chocolate. Right? I don't get it. It just makes me feel bad. Queasy. But then the right response to that case is to each their own taste. We allow that people maybe, as it were, are differently hardwired or have different setups. Something else is at stake in the case of an aesthetic judgment, namely on the basis of it, we think we are making something like, or indeed we are making, an objective claim. It is beautiful. So the feeling of harmony, the harmony is feelingly apprehended, and the apprehension, that's a phrase of Allison's, and the apprehension, like the harmony, is an inherently pleasurable mental state, that we seek to preserve. And when I say we seek to preserve it, we don't seek to preserve it, as it were, willfully, but rather being in that state is being in a state where we are simply spontaneously, as it were, seek to maintain it. So it is part of that state that it is experienced as self-preserving or self-maintaining. In the second introduction, pleasure is dealt with slightly differently. As we saw last week, when I talked about the lost pleasure in judgment, that pleasure there is almost solely looked at as a feeling in response to the attainment of an aim. Hence, if we were to think about aesthetic reflective judgments using that model, then the source of pleasure would be the discovery of a contingent fit between the object and our mental powers. That is,
let me try to explain that a bit better.
Part of the pleasure in natural beauty, assuming there is any, I have an essay where I claim there is none, but let's assume that it's possible. It's a kind of Heideggerian argument, you know, where, you know, you don't, I guess my example is I took my family to Yellowstone National Park, and, you know, there's the waterfalls and the whole thing, and my son, who at that point was 14 and already a deep cynic, said, "Man, this Disney Corporation knows how to make a park." And he just thought it looked like a Disney setup, right? He just couldn't see the nature. It was all already kitsch for him, right? So that he's someone who is insensitive. He finds natural beauty incomprehensible, right? It's already too late for that. But let's assume that it's possible to have a pleasure in an object of nature. When we withdraw from our, in this case we do withdraw from our ordinary conceptualized capacities and just examine the object aesthetically, even though we are not looking for order, we experience it. And because we experiencing it when we are not even searching for it, we think that the aims, the general aims of the mental faculties are being satisfied in a way that feels wholly spontaneous and accidental. Right? No one planned it, no one set it up, no one grounded it, and yet, nonetheless, there seems as if this flower was made to send me into a reverie of aesthetic pleasure. And therefore, it's as if nature itself was so made, so set up, so designed, as to let my mental powers exist in their full exuberance. So it's as if in that experience I find a general attunement between the way nature merely appears to the senses and our powers of cognition in general. So you may say, at that level, the experience of nature is riveting, somewhere Adorno says that beauties of nature can never be seen but only glimpsed. And what he means is that he's trying to answer my son. And he's saying to my son, you know, of course, if you look at it in a steady way, it's going to be oversaturated with anticipations and patterns that, you know, are just full of too many Hallmark cards and bad movies and bad photography to catch it. But it's as if you catch it out of the side of your eye, you're suddenly taken aback by its utter rightness. And that rightness is, again, the fitness of that object for our mental powers in a way that has no ground. So the question, then, that arises here is, does the principle... So what I'm suggesting here is what occurred in this stuff up here, the principle of the purposes of this, of nature. Remember, that's supposed to underlie our capacity for reflective judgments concerning system and concept formation and organism. Does the principle of the purposiveness of nature also underlie the possibilities of the judgment of taste? Is the ground of the judgment of taste the same as the ground, the principle, the purposiveness of nature, of aesthetic judgments? Now, this is a huge issue, and I should say at the very beginning of this discussion, the standard answer in all the literature is simply no, that they're two different things. Whatever goes on in aesthetics is different than what goes on in these other modes of reflection. So that all the standard handlings of aesthetic reflective judgment assume it is somehow discontinuous with reflective judgments that allow science, concept formation, and the judgments of organisms to be possible. And I'll be discussing that in about 5 minutes, about that separation and why one may question it. And that's what your handout from Allison is all about, which I'll get to in a moment. However, just at this point, at any rate, what I've just said, this question of fitness, raises the question that is significant in the second introduction, namely about the normativity of judgments of taste as opposed to other forms of pleasure and awareness. So page 191 in the published introduction. Kant says, I'll just read two short passages, but like any other empirical judgment, a judgment of taste claims only to be valid for everyone, and it is always possible for such a judgment to be valid for everyone, despite its intrinsic contingency. So when I make a judgment of taste, I am claiming that if anyone were placed in the same position I am with respect to this object and attended it appropriately, they too ought to feel pleasure. So there's an inherent claim of objectivity. And he says this even more emphatically in the next paragraph, where he says, in the same way, someone who feels pleasure in the mere reflection on the form of an object without any concern about a concept, rightly lays claim to everyone's assent, even though the judgment is empirical and a singular judgment. Now, and I should explain, what I've been doing all today, if I make this clear, is I'm just beginning to give you the basic architecture of a judgment of taste. The elements of the harmony of the faculties, that it's about pleasure, that now I'm saying that it's also a judgment that is valid for everyone, so I'm just giving you the general account of what a judgment of taste is. Now, in saying that the judgment of taste is a claim to be valid for everyone, that is, has this radical notion of objectivity. Yeah?
Well, I was just wondering, is it objectivity or is it sort of intersubjective validity? Since you say it's universally yet subjective.
Correct. Yeah, in this case, what objectivity is going to mean is universally, intersubjectively valid. Absolutely. The question, of course, you may ask is whether it ever means anything else. But that's something else. Okay, but certainly, yes. That's the claim here. Now, you may be surprised, and indeed, this is the depth and the mystery of aesthetic judgments, that they are both utterly subjective in the sense that they are really, really are about. And this is the radicality of Kant's claim, right? Kant is claiming that the word beauty does not pick out a feature of an object. What the word beauty does, even though I'm saying the rose is beautiful, when I say the rose is beautiful, it's not like saying the rose is red. The predicate beautiful does not refer to an objective property of the object, but rather refers to, right, the fact that that object apprehended in a certain way generates a harmony of the imagination and the understanding that gives me a feeling of pleasure, and a pleasure of such a kind that I am led to say, this is beautiful, meaning by that, that everyone faced with this object, if they judge it appropriately, ought to feel this same pleasure. Okay, this is simply part of the logic of a judgment of taste. Yeah.
Is he saying that anyone faced with this object and who feels the pleasure I feel should judge it appropriately, or anyone who faces the object should feel the same pleasure that I feel?
The latter.
Okay, that's a much more radical claim.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a real normative claim that there's only one way of responding to this object aesthetically, right? And if you don't get it, you know. But after all, I mean, this... So it is about the shareability, but it's also trying to understand why, despite the fact that we all know that there is an inelimitable deep subjectivity in aesthetic judgments, we care that other people agree with us or don't. And that's kind of surprising. If it's subjective like chocolate cake, I don't care whether it doesn't matter. But if at a certain moment the things that you find beautiful and I do utterly divide, and I wonder if we share the same world. Right? That's what Kant is trying to get at. That there's something about the way in which we are in the world and sharing a world that depends upon, in some sense, our capacity for this responsiveness that is in principle shareable. Joe?
find something beautiful, but I accept and respect your decision not to call it beautiful, not to find it beautiful. Does that mean that they're not really having what we call an aesthetic feeling, or is that they're misrepresenting it themselves?
They're misrepresenting its status. If they don't care at all, I mean, the point is, about any one aesthetic judgment, you know, we realize cases are difficult, that it takes cultivation. I mean, but after a while, to say, I don't care, means they don't know what the aesthetic is. That they think the aesthetic is like, the gravy is too thick, or too thin. Now, I like thin gravy. You know, I think it's just too thin. I like it, you know. Okay, families I know absolutely separate over this and get divorces and children are thrown out. But that's nuts, right? In aesthetics, it's what we're trying to do is find out or locate. This, not only we want to, of course, explain this normativity, but in explaining this normativity, we ought to be able to articulate why we take something that is essentially subjective, and yet someone might even want to base their life on just studying literature, for example. I don't know who would do that, but if they did, right? And
just a question, who decides that?
What do you mean, who decides that?
Well, who decides that all people should have the same response to...
No. It's not a who. This is about the very character of the judgment. Not someone deciding it. It's what's involved in a making of an aesthetic judgment itself. So that the finding beautiful is means you have, you are claiming that you have judged in a certain way, had a certain experience, and on the basis of judging in a certain way and having that experience, you are entitled to a certain claim, and the nature of that claim is one that holds, that is, everyone ought to share. There's a normativity intrinsic. I do folk crazy. No. This is, and by the way, just I don't want to get lost today, this is the fourth moment. So we have to kind of work up to it. We're still in the introduction. So I'm not gonna lay it out today, but this is just part of the logic. Yeah.
There's this other kind of objectivity though that we seem to encounter with aesthetic judgments in, say, our culture, something like the queer eye, the great eye approach, where it's, I mean, so, for instance...
I have no idea what you're talking about. That is too hip for me.
The idea of a style consultant, someone you might bring in because they are able to make these universally valid aesthetic judgments, and yet in that case, it's not... So you said first day, this is a class about epistemology. It's not going to be about, say, culture. So style consultants, for instance, are able to make objective aesthetic judgments, not because of anything epistemological going on, but because they understand our culture and what our culture finds attractive. I mean, I'm not sure. If you look at the way style changes from decade to decade, that sort of thing, that doesn't seem to be objective in the same sense.
It's culturally shared. I don't have an answer to the status of style. It's a great question, and no, it really is, and there's a debate, you know, now coming up that is huge about, you know, why, you know, is suddenly clothing part of, you know, our museum culture. I mean, there's a real issue here. What I want to say is that people who have that nose are having a nose for something other than aesthetic rightness. They're having a nose for what a culture will find attractive, not ought to find attractive, right? So that they're using their taste in order to make predictions about how people will respond. My judgment, when I go and, you know, and write about Cindy Sherman, I'm knowing that when I started doing it, no one shared my judgment, right? But I want to claim they ought to find these works, right? Both deep, complicated, and so on and so forth, and of a certain aesthetic demandingness. Even if no one agrees, I was not making a prediction, right? I was making a normative claim. That's the point I'm trying to make here. This is about the logical grammar of an aesthetic judgment. That's all we're interested in at the moment, just its grammar.
Okay, so then I have to ask, what happens when I look back at the how do I
Kant has a whole story of how taste changes and how we progress and how we develop and we learn. I mean, this is not an area, that's why I said it's not about raw fields. So we have to explain how it's not raw fields. We're beginning to do that. But it ain't raw fields, and therefore it's not surprising that cultivation should make a difference. Yeah?
So I just wanted to make sure, when you talk about how there's a normativity to aesthetic judgment as the ought, and for there to be a meaningfulness or a rich meaningfulness to the normativity, rather than just have a society of people who ought to and perhaps will share an appreciation or an aesthetic moment for censure.
Louder. There's a whole class here.
Rather than just have a shared world of people who merely have aesthetic moments of appreciating art, is there a larger, for it to be fully meaningful, I'm basically asking the question of morality. And is it necessary to attach it to morality for this normativity to be meaningful?
That's going to take like the last 4 weeks of the course, but all I want to say at this moment is that it's a normativity that is like the moral, but is not itself. It has, it doesn't have the notions of blameworthiness and the like attached to it, and therefore it doesn't have many of the features of a moral judgment. So it has an oughtish or demand-like character, but its grammar is, at the moment, I want to say, related to, just in the way, so what have I accomplished today? Well, I've tried, on the one hand, I've been trying to seduce you into thinking that there must be some relationship between the way in which we cognize objects and the way in which we're aesthetically aware of them. So I've attached aesthetic judgment to cognition. Now I'm saying that there's a normative dimension to aesthetic judgments, and I'm therefore attaching the character of aesthetic judgments to the domain of the moral. Right, you're right to feel that I'm trying to show that there's a way in which they are cognitive-like but not cognitive, and they're moral-like but not moral. And the deep question is, how do we understand those bits of sameness and difference in a way that preserves the integrity of the aesthetic, doesn't reduce it to the moral or the cognitive, and yet doesn't divorce it from those so far that it ends up just empty. Right? So we're trying, this is exactly this difficulty of this space. It's can judgments of taste be taught? They can't be taught the way concepts can be taught, and that's because exactly there are no rules. So if anyone's not getting it, right? So Cavell brings up the case, I'm trying to explain to you why this painting is beautiful. And I try, we were talking about this before, and I point to this feature and that feature, and I say, look at it this way, look at it that way. But at a certain moment, I have to say, don't you get it? That is, it's not about what I say, it's about your experience of the object. So in any aesthetic judgment, right, there has to be an immediate, and I want to say immediately, causal relationship between the individual doing the judging and the object judged. And that has to, and that, that causal relationship has to be ingredient in them coming to the judgment. Right? So you have to be really in sensory contact with it. You cannot make an aesthetic judgment about something that has merely been described to you. Oh yeah, that must be beautiful. Can't say that. You can only make a judgment of beauty when you are faced with the object because it involves apprehension. There has to be the apprehending going on. So there's a moment that is subjective of such a character that we know what cultivation can do. We know how, so we know how to teach it, but it's not teachable the way conceptual powers are teachable. Which is not to say it can't be learned. Who said that last night? It was
Chris Roberts.
The Chris Roberts thesis. Something can be not completely teachable, but fully learnable. Yeah.
I think the point you contributed a couple of weeks ago was that the most that ever can be done is that it can be practiced. Yeah. Continuous return to the activity of trying to apprehend.
And you expose, you know, people do. But Kant is assuming that it touches upon a priori structure of the mind, and that therefore, in principle, all human beings must be, in principle, open to the possibility of aesthetic judgment. Right? If they've got imagination and understanding, they must be. You can see your... You want it to be more teachable than that?
No, I just want to know if it's a different sort of case than the unteachable people that using rules and they're just bad. Make them a little bit better, but they're still not trying to be clever or something like that.
Mm.
Or whether it's more universalized all the time because it involves direct power, but more of this, like, the same thing with the two powers.
I think two things. I think on the one hand, I think this is partially an empirical question. And I'm assuming as an empirical matter of fact, there are some people whose minds have been so deformed that they are simply incapable of aesthetic judgments at all. That their lives have been so coarsened or rough. And Kant says, this is a privilege, right? Because this is a certain type of non-necessity, right? So he says that only under certain states of culture do people even begin to think about making aesthetic judgments, right? There has to be at least some freedom from necessity, right? Kant imagines, however small that freedom from necessity is. It would be surprising if someone who had the capacity and wasn't blocked off couldn't be suitably encouraged. But again, it's not teachable the way I know anyone with ordinary intelligence can be taught 2 plus 2 equals 4. Okay. The puzzle about normativity, but getting to the topic, I think I can do an introduction. Anyway. So the whole semester on the introduction. If, for Kant, if something is normative, then it requires an a priori principle. It has to have a basis in our capacities for encounter with the world in general. Normativity doesn't come out of nowhere. You know, what comes out of nowhere are causal facts. Normativity has to have a ground, and the ground has to be human, because there's nothing for Kant a priori in the world. A priori refers to the structures by means of which we encounter the world. well, what might be the a priori principle grounding the possibility of the normativity of aesthetic judgments? And what I've been suggesting for the last few moments is that at least it's not implausible to consider that the principle of purposiveness, which is the ground for judgments of system, of concept formation, and organism, might also be the ground for aesthetic reflective judgments. So on page 193 in the second introduction, just what I mean by the principle of purposiveness is what Kant says in the middle of that page. He says, but it is only a principle of judgment by which it provides itself with concepts in nature's immense diversity, so that judgment can orient itself in this diversity. We are still attributing to nature, on the analogy of a purpose, a concern, as it were, for our cognitive power. That is, that's what we're doing when we make system. Hence, now he's drawing the analogy with natural beauty, hence we may regard natural beauty as the exhibition of the concept of formal, merely subjective purposiveness, and may regard natural purposes as the exhibition of the concept of real objective purposiveness, the first of which we judge by taste, aesthetically, by means of the feeling of pleasure, and the second by understanding and reason, logically according to the concept. So Kant's suggesting there that finding things beautiful is finding them as if nature designed them for our cognitive powers. That would underlie or ground that kind of judgment. Now, everyone thinks that when Kant says this, he's simply making a wild and overwhelming mistake. And the reason that they think he's making a mistake is first that it makes the relationship between aesthetic reflective judgments and cognitive judgments much too close, so that a problem that we'll see later is, if you follow the principle of the purposiveness of nature, why isn't it the case that all natural objects that we can judge are beautiful? And if we think it's not true that all objects are beautiful, then maybe something's wrong with this account. Secondly, if we think that the principle of the purposiveness of nature is what underlies the objectivity of judgments of taste, what happens to art? That means that art would operate on a totally different basis than the beauty of nature. Now, it sounds like, and those seem to me important things to say. And in saying them, we are being very Hegelian. Because Hegel says our model for the judgments of art, for judgments of beauty, should be judgments of art. And we ought to think of judgments about natural beauties as parasitic on what is truly spiritual, namely art. Kant clearly wants to make the paradigm of a judgment of beauty a judgment of natural beauty, and wants to extend that account somehow into art. Now, the way in which, and I won't talk about it here, but I will talk about it later in the semester when we talk about art, the way in which the question of the beauty of nature could be related to the question of art is by considering the role in art of mediums. If art is necessarily medium-bound and medium-specific in its operations, then those mediums themselves, the medium of paint to be color and line, the medium of music to be sound, harmony, rhythm, the medium of so on and so forth, then those art mediums may be portions of nature worked up into cultural form. So art may be the becoming culture of nature, or the way in which we experience nature in a fully cultural way. That would be, some story along those lines would be necessary, and I'll talk about that later in the semester. But that's what, as it goes, that's what my whole book, Against Voluptuous Bodies, is about. Just that question. Yeah?
Does that imply that all art is mimetic of nature?
No. It doesn't follow that any is mimetic.
Or mimetic of any.
Yeah. It doesn't follow it's mimetic at all. Yeah. Yeah. Don't need that. Medium is just is the question of whether what makes something a work of art is connected to the intrinsic powers of the medium in which it is produced. Or whether the medium in which it's produced is extrinsic to the character of the work of art. Right. So Ken Wark across the street, who's our great thinker about digital powers, thinks that the question of the medium is just a mistake, and we can do it all on computers. And when he says that, I quiver. Right. I think the medium, our interest in art concerns our interest in the mediums, the materials, and the powers of those materials. Materials are not raw things. They're things with certain powers. That's what intrigues us. Or to put it another way, just I can see your puzzle about the notion of medium. What makes a meaning, an art meaning, is that it is not translatable out of the medium in which it is presented. So that there are meanings where what medium they're presented in, it just doesn't matter. What you're interested in is the meaning itself, right? So whether I tell you, you know, call home E.T., and whether I do that by drum beats or by words or by smoke, it doesn't matter. It's the propositional content. Now, I'm saying in an artwork, the propositional content is not detachable from the material character of its presentation. And I want to say that that is, I want to claim that's definitive of what makes art art for us traditionally. Of course, we have conceptual art, we have all sorts of things, and I'd want to contest those things. Yeah.
Yeah, how would you apply that to poetry or literature?
That's easy. Medium is word. How words... It's, remember, everyone talks about poetry as the capacity to turn language back on itself so that we're as interested in the language. So in what we say in artworks is the medium is not a transparent vehicle for the meaning. You can't appreciate a poem without appreciating the words and the order of the words, the exact order of the words, and the way in which those words sound, et cetera, et cetera. So all the features of language contribute to the meaning of a poem, while some people say a perfect philosophical style, you shouldn't even notice that it was written. Right to the concepts themselves. A certain fantasy, but it's a nice fantasy, right? It's a certain platonic fantasy. that's how I think the notion of medium and nature may be related to one another. Now, let me rehearse anyway the argument for the connection and Allison's objections to it. So it's the handout I gave you. Allison, on that handout, on page 61, I don't know. You have to share a copy with somebody. It's page 61 of Allison, for those of you who have the book. And it's the first full paragraph on the page. It's the five wonderful, as I tell you, Allison's always boring, right? So it's five steps of an argument, right? Perfectly. But that's fine. And this perfectly useful, helpful thing. So here's the argument for thinking about, let's be clear what we're talking about here, thinking that the judgment of taste is grounded on the principle, the purposiveness of nature. And Kant's reasoning in these passages, the passages are the one I just read you, and if you're interested, in the first introduction, pages 232-3 and pages 243, all of them have the same way of trying to join together aesthetic with these other forms of judgment. Kant's reasoning in these passages must be roughly as follows. We have seen that the inclusion of judgment in the system of higher cognitive faculties requires that it have its own a priori or transcendental principle. Two. So in introducing the notion of judgment in consideration of science, we're going to use judgment in science getting, it requires a foundation, right? How do we, you know, what's the role of judgment in reflecting on species and genre? Two. We have also seen that the formal or logical purposiveness of nature is such a principle. That is what licenses the operation of judgment, is the assumption that nature is purposive for our understanding. That's the principle of the purposiveness of nature. Three, but judgments of taste are merely reflective judgments, make a claim for universality and necessity. Four, if this claim is legitimate, it must rest on an a priori principle, and since the judgments are merely reflective, do not involve determination, it must be a principle that pertains to judgment in its reflective capacity. Since the purposiveness of nature has already been shown to be such a principle, judgments of taste must be based on it, or at least they must be if their claims are to be warranted. Okay, let me rehearse now Allison's objections to this argument. His first objection is that it does not follow from the fact that the principle of purposiveness is the a priori principle of reflective judgment in logical reflection, that it must likewise be the same principle underlying aesthetic reflective judgments. There's no direct inference here. And further, it's not the case that we should think this plausible because logical reflection concerns reflection on diverse forms, whereas judgments of taste are concerned with the purposiveness of judgment for particular forms. That is, one thing that whenever we're looking for concepts, we're always looking for forms, that is, concepts that apply to more than one object. The thing about a judgment of taste is it is only, I haven't mentioned this yet, a judgment of taste can only be singular. Because you have to be an immediate, right, empirical relationship with the object. So judgment of taste always has to be about this object. And you can, of course, say some roses are beautiful, But in saying that, you're not making a judgment of taste directly. Rather, you're saying, I have judged some roses, and every one of them I have found to be beautiful. That is, it can only be... And you could even say, maybe all, but again, the ground of the judgment has to be singular. So all judgments of taste, properly speaking, are just singular, about one object, this. And that makes them wholly unlike the rest of this stuff. Now, that argument, I mean, that fact is true. I don't want to contest what Allison says there. I don't think the inference he draws from it is true. That is, that's a ground for a separation. And the reason I want to contest Allison here is because I could not compare the schema of diverse objects unless I could, for this particular object, something schema-like was possible. That is, the very capacities that allow me to do the work of concept formation here presuppose my capacity in general to find individual objects having intrinsic schema-like coherence themselves. Now, in saying this, I'm claiming what I said I was going to claim last week. Namely, I said that the thought of system presupposes the possibility of concept formation. And I'm suggesting that the possibility of concept formation presupposes the capacity for individual judgment. That is, I don't see how we can go about the business of concept formation unless we also have the capacity displayed in aesthetic reflective judging. So the thought might be something like this. Why isn't it the case that the bedrock presupposition for the entire hierarchy, going right up to science, is an aesthetic reflective judgment, that is, our attunement to objects in general, rather than thinking, as Allison plainly is, that we should draw a line severing aesthetic reflective judgments from these other forms of reflective activities? Isn't there something overly... there's something about the severance theory that simply wants to hide the aesthetic off from any of the other considerations we've had so far. Yeah?
I kind of see it, but I'm wondering... I guess Allison's claim is something like for aesthetic, for merely reflective judgments in these cases,
mm-hmm.
that there's not this kind of activity in which we're making comparisons, but it's a singular
right.
thing that we're judging.
Yep.
And because of that, we don't need to assume the principle. So does that seem right?
Well, not by itself, because we're asking, would we still, for either activity, we need a ground for the judgment. And I'm suggesting the principle of the purposiveness might be ground, can certainly be thought of as grounding there.
And Allison's saying, because of the singularity, it's not grounding, it's merely reflective judgment.
That it's so different. So his argument is not that it isn't, it's that it's so different in its character that to think of it as in the same problematic as these draws on the principle of purposiveness unnecessarily. That is, it's not actually recognizing what is distinctive about aesthetic reflective judgment. And their unlikeness means that And of course, he thinks that there are other ways to ground them other than the principle, the purposes of nature. So he's trying to get rid of this argument. So he's saying, so it's a claim of unlikeness, right? And my answer is, the unlikeness is not as unlike as he's claiming. That is, the particular general distinction can't quite do the work because you can't do generals without doing particulars.
But isn't it so? The principle, though, when we're forming concepts and making these comparisons, it's really not even at the level of general and particular, but at the level of likeness between different things that we're judging and attempting to form a schema and eventually form a concept. So wouldn't that be the place at, not at general or particular, but at that kind of likeness between different objects that we would want to insert the need for the principle that has grounded?
The thing of constant examples, you can't start comparing things until you have one. You've got to look at the first house before you can think about looking at a second house, right? And you've got to at least make the effort of engaging it, and so that the next time you hit one, you don't think, oh, it's another, you know,
exactly,
pile of rubble.
But if it's an aesthetic, merely reflective judgment, you only have one.
Right.
So the act of comparing, which is, seems like what you would need, you would need to assume the principle of purposiveness in order to compare.
To have grounds for going about the business of comparing.
Yes.
And I'm saying, but what about the grounds for making the first apprehensive look? What makes you so much as think you will find anything like? And that's not the question. It's rather, when you do find it, what makes you think it's general? Why should you think it's universalizable? Why should you think your judgment, to use a more technical term, is exemplary of what it is to judge that object? That's our mystery here. Yeah.
Is the purposiveness of nature the normative that you're looking at? Maybe I'm just not getting a connection, but I mean, can you think of the purposiveness of nature as the normative of...
No, it's not normative. It's the ground. What we're looking for is a basis, a ground for our belief that we're entitled, in making an aesthetic judgment, to claim that it is universal. Now, I might make that claim if I thought that in feeling beauty, I was feeling the harmony between nature and the powers of the imagination in general. That's my way of doing the grounding operation. That's what Allison is claiming is not kosher. Are we all clear about the stakes? I can see I'm having an argument with myself here. And I'm punching myself, punching back, and everyone's watching me, no idea what's going on. It's like Fight Club, right? Only I'm the only guy in the ring. Okay. So the argument here, let's be clear, is we know what a judgment of taste is. It has a certain normativity. The question we're interrogating is, what is the ground that entitles us to that normativity. Okay? So the principle of the purposiveness of nature is what Kant suggests as the ground in both the introductions, and that he drops completely in the main body of the text, which is why there's a debate about the issue, right? It doesn't reemerge later on when he actually does make an explicit attempt. It only emerges in these introductory comments, in both introductions. Okay? And I'm saying, well, maybe there's something about what's going on in the introductions that Kant backed off from in the main body of the text. And just to remind, why am I saying that? Because I've already said to you, going back into week one, week two, that in the archaeology of the text, the whole of paragraphs 1 through 22 and 31 through 39 or something like that, you know, roughly the analytic of the beautiful without the sublime, was written completely before he wrote either introduction. So it's not surprising that material that is appearing in the introduction doesn't fully cohere with what we find in the Analytic of the Beautiful, because the Analytic of the Beautiful was composed first, then he got the idea for reflective judgment after he'd already composed the Analytic of the Beautiful, and then composed the stuff on the sublime, and then the stuff on morality and art, and the whole second half on nature. Okay, that was my archaeology of the text. So I'm dealing with what was called an archaeological stratum of Kant's argument that is undecided. Let me just finish the argument since it's already Thursday, and we'd like to leave. I'm sure they'll throw us out. So let me just say a few more words. No, ask a question and I'll come back to this. Ask the question, and then we'll finish with that, and then we'll pick it up next week.
So, if I understand what you're saying, that your claim is that the principle is necessary to ground the objectivity that we can make when we make an aesthetic judgment.
Right.
Okay.
That's what is. So what he does on page 61 is he's laying out that argument of grounding. And then the rest of the next few pages to say why that argument's false. Okay? And I'm saying it's probably false, but there's something in it that we need to consider. Right? And what I'm asking you to consider is what I was worried about. Let me say why I'm doing this. Maybe my motives need exposing here. I am worried that if you utterly sever aesthetics from all the considerations of how we judge nature, then what on earth is aesthetics going to be about? That was my problem at the very beginning, the very class. I said, what is aesthetics about? Why do we care about it? And why do people keep trying to get rid of it, you know? Knowledge is this, morality is that, and they talk about everything. So they don't talk about everything, there's something left over. And what's left over, I'm suggesting, is at least this. Our sensible, subjective relation to the world. How we are attuned to the world as sensing and feeling creatures. And aesthetics is the attempt to get at a stratum of experience. This is why all of Deleuze is really an aesthetics, right? It's trying to get at that notion where of experience prior to, again, an independent of cognition that yet joins us both to the world and to one another. Hence the normativity.
Accept this continuum view.
Yep.
Doesn't the singularity at the bottom of it get swept up into the higher level?
That's
you lose
great.
The singularity again.
Right. So the danger is that either you instrumentalize aesthetics and make it just a precursor to scientific cognition, in which you want to say, who cares about aesthetics? Or you detach it, and then you get aestheticism, and it's about nothing. So the question is, how do we sustain? This is why this is so difficult. Trying to get at exactly what sustains this possibility of significance without either emptying it out into mere self-referentiality or instrumentalizing it either for cognition or even worse for morality, which is what Kant did do, I'll show you, at the end of the book. he decided the whole thing was really a mistake and we should just use the whole thing as a way of getting to be more moral and better and gooder people. Since I don't want to be good, I was never interested in that bit, but we'll pick up here. Now, next week, we are now, as always, of course, we're now, like, you know, 6 months behind. We will deal next week with at least the first two moments. Please, come back 1 second. And in the second moment is one of the most important paragraphs in the whole book, paragraph 9. So when you are reading, you must spend hours getting disturbed and trying to make sense of paragraph 9, which is, he says, the key to the understanding of the judgment of taste. So it must be important. Okay?